From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we catch up with WUWM's Rachel Morello on the week in education news and hear from some parents she spoke with about school choice.
I think some of it is looking at what's the work product that the students are able to produce, where they're problem solving really creatively, problems that are interesting to them that they come up with solutions for.
Then we visit Northwestern Mutual's new garden plaza.
We'll find out about the hot water problem that brought the show Ask This Old House to Bayview.
You know, the issue of these instantaneous is it needs a bigger gas pipe, and it has to go against the outside wall. You know, so oftentimes you're relocating, and that's what we did on the segment.
And Bubbler Talk tells the story of an unusual restaurant that resides in the memories of many Milwaukeeans. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. With the calendar reading late January, semester exams are a thing of the past for Wisconsin students, and that means it's time for the second semester.
It is also time for another quiz about the week in education news with WUWM's education reporter, Rachel Morello. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Mitch. I have a shorter quiz for you this week. It's two questions, but there's a surprise at the end.
Are they calling them quizzes or are these formative assessments?
Sure, formative assessments. Can't believe I just said that. Okay, so first, I'm going to read you a quote from a statement that was issued this week by three community organizations. I'll name them really quick. The Milwaukee branch of the NAACP, the League of United Latin American Citizens of Wisconsin, and the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Here's the quote. This action highlights the urgency of taking actions to ensure that the school celebrates tolerance and inclusion as part of its curriculum and culture. So those three groups I mentioned earlier released this statement in response to something that happened this week in one local school district. Do you know what that was?
Was this the question about on somebody's homework about slavery, asking people to identify some possible arguments for slavery, right?
Right. Funny you should mention that. It was not.
Oh.
But this is sort of a similar instance, and it kind of brings about a larger discussion that some schools are having. This particular incident, earlier this week, a photo started circulating on Facebook showing a racist message that was scrawled above the bubblers at Franklin High School. Basically, someone had ripped out a sheet of paper and written white above one of the bubblers and colored above another, which is clearly a reference to a documented practice from the era of segregation in some parts of the country. The signs have since been taken down, but the photo obviously spread like crazy around the internet, and it prompted these organizations I mentioned earlier to raise concern. In addition to calling on the district to increasing awareness of these different cultures, they said there are really easy ways you can do this. For example, celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a district-wide holiday, which a lot of districts do, but Franklin does not. And for their part, leaders within the Franklin School District sent a letter to staff and families calling the incident an act of intolerance and assuring the community members that they would take action to identify the student and address the behavior. The incident you mentioned, though, is similar, and this is just sort of a larger conversation that a lot of schools are having about issues of race and tolerance, and it's politics in the classroom, and it's a tough thing to talk about.
Absolutely.
So, okay, let's talk about something else. This is a topic that affects all districts around the state. A report came out this week from a local conservative think tank. You might be familiar with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WIL for short. They say their research shows that this one federally funded program has had a negative effect on student test scores and suspension rates. The acronym for that program is PBIS. I'm going to have you give you three options for what that stands for. Is it performance-based insight statistics, positive behavioral intervention and supports, that's option B, or public broadcasting in schools?
I believe as much as it would be nice if it were option C, I think it is option B.
You are correct. It is B, positive behavioral intervention and supports. It's a federal school discipline policy that was implemented during President Obama's presidency, and the goal is to find what the feds called a multi-tiered approach to behavior support, so basically finding alternative ways to deal with issues of student behavior. researchers at Will say these types of policies have hurt academic performance in Wisconsin schools. They basically say that PBIS promotes quote-unquote softer discipline policies. And they say it's impacted proficiency in math and reading. The scores for those things, they say, are lower in schools where PBIS is in place. And they say there's evidence that teachers and students feel less safe in those schools. Now, on the part of districts, districts like MPS have had PBIS in place for a number of years, and they have touted the positive benefits. Not only are suspensions going down, but they say PBIS has reduced classroom disruptions. So it'll be interesting to hear what kind of reaction districts have to this research, if any.
So I went 1 for 2, which not the greatest percentage in the world, but anything else in education news on our radar?
Well, I wanted to give you a little update. I promised you a surprise at the end here. Last week, you might remember, we put out a call to parents to send us their stories about how they picked a school for their kids. And we heard from a lot of parents, and today marks the end of National School Choice Week. So to wrap things up, I thought we could play a few of the submissions we received.
That's great. Let's hear them.
I am the first generation of the immigrants from China. When my wife and I choose schools for our son, daughter, three important factors in our mind. One is the neighborhood. And the second is what kids are our kids going to be with. And number three would be the academic performance.
I think some of it is looking at what's the work product that the students are able to produce, where they're problem solving really creatively, problems that are interesting to them that they come up with solutions for. I think test scores are things that parents look at a lot, and while those are important, I wouldn't say that those are really great at differentiating what's going to turn your student into someone who is a curious and capable learner.
No funcionó para mí su modelo educativo.
The captive model did not work for me. Another thing that motivated me was finding a school with a drive-through service, which at this time is necessary for us because our children are small.
As a mother of four daughters, taking my children to a school that teaches family values and morals is just as important as the education itself. Additionally, coming from a traditional Mexican family, it is important for me and my husband to celebrate traditions.
So that's all I got, Mitch.
Always nice to see you. Can't wait to take my next quiz, which I can't imagine ever having said in school.
I can't wait either. Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks, Rachel.
Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. You can read more of her coverage and submit your questions about learning and education in Wisconsin at WUWM.com/education.
Coming up after a break, architecture critic Tom Bamberger explores Northwestern Mutual's new gardens at the end of Wisconsin Avenue. We'll find out what he thinks when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tom Bamberger is not shy. The award-winning photographer and architecture critic is known for his acerbic take on the shortcomings of Milwaukee's architecture and public spaces.
So it was a bit of a surprise when Bamberger recently sent me a review that was downright glowing. In fact, this article followed a previous one that was equally fulsome. So before we got to the review subject itself, I was curious where all this positivity was coming from.
I wouldn't call it a New Year's resolution, but it did occur to me that on the internet, there is so much sourness sort of permeates our culture that I have made an effort to write more about things that I love. And I think ultimately that has a larger impact. It's very easy to diss things, to be superior to something. But when you love something or you get behind it in a fulsome way, I think it's a little more vulnerable. It's a little more meaningful.
Present, maybe.
Yeah.
Even.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what you're talking about in this article are the gardens, Northwestern Mutual's gardens.
Yes.
What is it that you love about them?
Well, I guess the first thing, and I've always wanted to say this on the radio, I'm a critic of urban design. And most of the stuff that I cover is where people are just sort of faking it. You know, they're trying to make a buck and they're not really trying. They're just trying to get the building built and to get it through the committees. But this is a case where they really tried, where they hired a really fantastic and well-known landscape architect named James Burnett, and they really tried. And there's so much I like about it, but the one thing, if you remember, they used to have this little park there that was sort of like an Olmstedian park. It had kind of a curvy path, and it had trees.
Lots of trees
that buffered the sidewalk in the city. And that's a very familiar kind of landscape. But what really caught my eye is the rationality of this landscape. It's classically drawn. There's lots of straight lines, lots of rectangles, which has been something that has been totally removed from our landscape. It's a completely new thing in America.
For designed landscapes
since, well, if you look at all of our parks.
Basically Olmsted.
Olmsted, right.
So the idea, you know, I always think of Olmsted as something that's supposed to be organic. There's these fluid shapes, and
exactly.
It's almost amoebic, you know. And so the idea here is that they're getting away from that, or that they have gotten away from
yes.
that.
Yes. So Olmsted, I got into a little trouble in my article because if you look in the comment section, because I said something about Olmsted that he hated cities, and there's all these people in Milwaukee that love Olmsted because they love Lake Park, and you know my dad wanted his ashes in Lake Park. Everybody loves Lake Park, but Olmsted, and you're exactly right. Olmsted actually was a big proponent of cities. He was a progressive, and he saw the potential for cities to create new ways of living. And he even wrote about women. You know, women didn't have to work on the farm. They could be involved with culture. And there was a division of labor in cities that allowed all these possibilities, all this opportunity. But during the time that he was forming his ideas, cities were an absolute disaster. They were a cesspool. I mean, New York City, from 1820, it grew from 152,000 to 1 million people.
On the island of Manhattan.
From 1860 to 1820. And then there were these just cataclysmic problems with sanitation and so forth. So if you read Stieglitz's letters to O'Keefe, leaving the city, the country home was basically a health club.
And so was Central Park meant to be a respite?
Yes,
in the city?
No. And, yep. and so he actually talks about it very explicitly as a prophylactic. It was therapeutic. And you're right about the organic shapes. He hated the grid. And he wanted to create these organic shapes, and everything is like organic, swirls around in Milwaukee and all the Olmstedian things. But it's also been adopted in golf courses and all the suburbs. They took this grammar of Olmsted to give you a break from the city. And if you go to Central Park, you notice that there's always like a line of trees. You're supposed to leave the city because the city, though not in principle a bad thing, was a nightmare. Was a literally pathogenic, as they called it. And there were writings about this. This isn't, you know, about the therapeutic qualities of nature. And he thought that he was making the city livable and civilized. And it goes along with the Jeffersonian idea of the goodness of the country. And most of the intellectuals, you know, kind of thought the city was like a bad thing. And the country was what renewed you and gave you good values.
Get back to nature, the idea
yes.
of getting back.
Right.
Well, and I find it so funny because when you look at the Olmstedian type of park, Lake Park being a perfect example,
mm-hmm.
We tend to forget, I think, that that was just as constructed as this new garden
exactly.
in front of Northwestern Mutual, that it's no more quote-unquote natural.
Right.
One is no more natural than the
Olmsted
other.
Olmsted used more explosives to make Central Park than was used in the Civil War. It's a crazy thing. And, you know, the amount of trees and so forth. No, so it is a construction. It's a pastoral construction. And what's interesting is this was a response to really unlivable cities, cities that didn't have sanitation. All of a sudden, skyscrapers are going up, you know, this incredible growth of urban life. So now what I find fascinating is now all of a sudden we can go back to the grid. Now, there's the Kylie Gardens in front of the PAC, which is probably the first one, and I think that's 60s or 70s. Nothing happened since then. Kylie was a lone wolf. Then there's the Kylie straight line thing in front of the museum. But now, if you notice, underneath the freeway, the new freeway construction by Lincoln Moore Drive, there's actually a grid of trees, which is a completely new thing. And I think grids and straight lines, all the things that Olmsted hated, is our nature. Something about human beings. You know, one of the greatest things we ever did was geometry, to imagine a straight line. There are really no straight lines in nature. You know, when people first laid the first railroad track that went to a straight line to a horizon, it's, you know, a fantastic, arresting human thing. So the grammar, what I love about the Burnett thing, the Northwestern Mutual Gardens, is that it reflects, it celebrates the rectilinearity of the city rather than trying to buffer. You can look in the ordinances. There's 58 different mentions of buffering in the city ordinances.
For any kind of greenery or a park.
Yeah,
or
you
something.
Buffer. You have okay. to buffer all of these things. But now we've, you know, all the industries moved out of cities. We're not slaughtering pigs in cities anymore. We actually have sanitation. We're not walking in human
excrement.
Excrement. Yeah, thanks. I was looking for the right word there.
The one we can say on the radio.
The one you can say on the radio, right. And now that, you know, people are living in a city, unlike any city that's ever existed in
and
America.
And by choice.
And by choice. And understanding they're interested in the connectivity of a city. Now we have this garden that is really connected. When you walk through it, you realize how, first of all, how it sweeps around the building, which sweeps, and how connected it is to that, but how it fits into, rather than buffers, this sort of rectilinearity of the city. And the same thing's happening under the freeway, and I'm thinking, wow, that's interesting. It was just a given that if you wanted something nice, in quotes, you'd have to have a curvy, you know, people wanted to live at the end of the cul-de-sac.
Quote, unquote, natural, going
right.
back to that, you know, this.
Natural.
But constructed natural.
Yes.
And I'm going back to something you said about the idea of the grid, the straight line is very human. And it almost seems like in the case of this garden, if we're going to construct nature, which
right.
is what we're doing with any of this, we might as well construct it to represent what we are and who we are.
You know, I would put it a slightly different way, but I think you're right. I don't know that we really know who we are. Human beings aren't that smart. We think we know, but I'm not so sure we do. But I do think that one thing that human beings do, I mean, if you've ever seen a picture many times in France, the landscape, they may have a road and just perfect line trees down the road. You know, things that stand out where human beings have interacted with the landscape that are not, in quotes, organic, are just fascinating and wonderful and arresting. Now, I studied evolutionary theory in college and in graduate school, and of course, Darwin wouldn't think that anything human beings do would be inorganic. It's kind of a weird Christian idea that nature is good and we are bad, but we're actually part of nature, and our beehive, things that we make we do straight lines, we do boxes. Now with a computer,
we like symmetry.
Right, we can do curvy things.
Yep.
But I think there's something about the rectilinear, the 90-degree angle in a straight line, the sharpness of it, the clarity of it, that has also been, you know, exploited in minimalist art in the 20th century. It was a huge discovery of sort of just basic human shapes.
Well, and from your article, you both not only like the design, you like being in it.
Mm-hmm.
You like actually spending time in the space.
Right.
So from the pictures, I mean, I've walked by it.
Mm-hmm.
I have not spent time in it. For you, when you approach it, what is it that feels welcoming to you? Is it that rectilinearity, or is it a combination of that and something else?
I don't know that welcoming, you know, let me put it this way. We like to think that nature is good and it's there for us and it cares about us. But in many ways, you know, nature, of course, is indifferent. And in some ways, what's arresting about an organized space is that it's unnatural, that it's...
We've kept nature at bay.
Yes, that nature, it's all those little crooks and crannies and all that chaos, something that you can't really wrap your mind around, has been organized, linearized, clarified, refined, and that we've exerted control.
I was going to say, some would say sanitized, that has all been sanitized so that it's more appealing to us.
Oh,
I don't know.
Yeah, see, I would think that the sort of diluted Olmstedian landscape is
more sanitized.
Is more, it's more like those, you know, those tissues you buy with cute little designs on them to wipe your butt, you know, or whatever. Like, you don't want to just have a regular white piece of paper that you pull off and it's a perfect rectangle. We put some curvy design on it, you know.
Yep.
But no, I think there's a bit of awe when you go in there because the space is variegated and there's different levels. And when you're up by the building, the sweep of the building and then the sweep of the city, is all of this man-made, and then, of course, there's the lake, is kind of inspiring. If you think about nature where we lived, when people came over the Appalachian Mountains into what was called the West at the time, they couldn't see anywhere more than 30 feet because it was all trees. You know, we cut down trees to make fields. And to create these spaces is kind of, rather than it being cloistered and, you know, sitting around a bush. I always think that the Olmstedian idea for the suburbs is that everybody, rather than looking at a beautiful building or the sweep of architecture or something man-made, they get to look at their very own bush. That's, you know, that's the great thing. And this is not looking at a bush. It's not being hemmed in. It's open and expansive. And straight lines have a kind of Euclidean infinity associated with them. You know, they kind of can go on forever in your mind. So the way the lines sort of connect up with the larger world is, that's kind of breathtaking. It's also exposed as people. People are on precipices. They're exposed. This isn't where everybody's in their little nook and private. People are on display, much like, you know, Juno Park used to be, where people used to promenade around. So it's a good place to watch people. I mean, it's not finished yet. It'll be very interesting for me to see how it's inhabited, you know, this summer. And I'm sure that in the plaza area, they'll have events and so forth. And the trees are going to grow. But even if you look at all the gardening, it is rational. There's a block of this sort of plant, a block of this. You could even say it's kind of crude, but in the sense that if a child did it, they might, you know, make a block of this and a block of that. But there's something... The simplicity of it, I think, is kind of courageous rather than sort of messing it all up.
How does it work with the building?
Wonderfully. It's reverent to the building. And, you know, the building has this fantastic sweep to it.
And it is curved.
Yes. Oh, no, it has a beautiful arc to it. There are ordinances where, and if you look at a lot of landscaping at McDonald's or whatever, or even at old-fashioned apartment buildings, they always have bushes buffering, you know, even the suburbs, buffering the intersection between the lawn or the landscape and the building. Like there's something obscene there. This design celebrates the seam between the building and the land. It's naked. It's bare. It's explicit. Everything's explicit. You get to see all the moving parts. Nothing's obscured. So,
and you are, from what you're saying, you are one of the moving parts.
Yes.
If you're in that space.
Right, yes, yeah. And yes, absolutely. So I just so appreciate, I mean, I think that this kind of landscape and, you know, what's under the freeway, I think it's going to really change the way a lot of people see urban spaces. You know, it's kind of ironic now, don't you think it's ironic that, you know, Olmsted was really anti-urbanist to the cities of today. He was an urbanist in the cities of his day that were cesspools. But we've somehow canonized this anti-urbanist design. And I don't want to, I mean, people are going to just hate me. I mean, I love Olmsted.
No, but you're talking about of his time,
yes.
It made sense. The
yes.
design made sense. We're in a different time, and we use cities in a different way. We live in them in a different
exactly.
way. We interact with them in a different way. And so there's nothing, to me, that's sacred about hanging on to a design that no longer works for the way you use a space.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it doesn't work at all. It works some of the time. What's amazing to me is how it is more or less a religion. Every single suburb, golf courses, every single constructed landscape has these curvy and the almond ponds and that this grammar has, it's sort of like a kudzu that has overrun, you know. And so I think this is such a relief. And Burnett has really sort of integrated Kylie and Olmsted to a certain extent. But it's just so interesting. Kylie having these two pieces here, and I think they want to get rid of the Grove at the PAC. I heard some rumor that would be stupid, of course. But the fact that Kylie was such a lone wolf in America. I met him right before he died when he came to Milwaukee. And if you look at his things, they were just amazing. He worked with Sarin in a lot of projects, but his modernist idea of the rational landscape was totally rejected by America. So I guess what
so
I...
So do you think this is a turning point?
I think it's a turning point in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at what's under the freeway, I mean, grids are fantastic. A grid of trees is a organized orchards are fantastically beautiful. And you know how people learn from their immediate environment? I think that we're going to see the land around buildings organized in a different way.
And we will talk about it when it happens.
Yes.
So, Tom Bamberger, always great to have you in the studio. Happy 2018, and we will talk again soon.
Nice seeing you, Bonnie.
Photographer and architecture critic Tom Bamberger's review of Northwestern Mutual's Garden Plaza is at Urban Milwaukee. You'll find a link and pictures from WUWM.com.
We will take another break and then have a different kind of architecture interview. Audrey Nowakowski goes behind the scenes with Ask This Old House as it tackles a water heater problem in a Bayview basement. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee is a city with a lot of old houses, and with so many old homeowners, there are more than a few who would recognize a distinctive truck and trailer that travels the country to help fix some vexing home problems.
Ask This Old House is a spinoff of the popular PBS series This Old House, which takes their experts on the road to personally assist projects homeowners need help with. Not too long ago, the truck and trailer made an appearance in Bayview at the home of Mark Nagel to solve a hot water issue, or rather, a lack of hot water issue.
The results air tomorrow evening on Milwaukee PBS. Mark Nagel joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio, and Ask This Old House plumbing and heating expert Richard Trithewey joined them by phone from Massachusetts. Nagel starts by explaining how the trailer ended up in front of his house.
I'm a huge fan, and we live in an old house, a 1900s house, and I submitted a request to Ask This Old House, and last spring, Sarah, the producer, just randomly called. I saw a Boston area code on my cell phone, and I picked it up, and I talked to Sarah, and I was blown away. And then, you know, the process went pretty quickly, and then, you know, here comes June, and there's Richard in the crew. lo and behold, we had some, you know, issues with a hot water heater. We have an old house, and it was vented improperly, and it was absolutely incredible that they came and were able to do everything, you know, in 6 hours, make some connections with my family. It was a surreal, it was an awesome experience we'll never forget.
Excellent. So from the time you submitted that email to the call, how long was that?
Probably five, six months.
Okay, yeah. Not too bad at all.
Yeah.
And Richard, how do you guys determine which houses you want to travel to around the country?
We have no shortage of candidates that would love us to come visit them. And then so we'll decide if we want to go to a particular market. And then our producers are sort of amazing at managing almost like multi-level chess, because they'll say, all right, let's go to this. Let's look at the mailbag about different, you know, requests. And then, all right, what on-camera people will be going? Will it be Tommy Silva? Will it be me? Will it be Roger Cook? And then we sort of talk to the homeowners. We're going to be sure the homeowners are into it, you know, and want to be part of it, which Mark was certainly one of those guys. And then it's easy. Then we're treated so wonderfully. We come to town. You know, we've hit all 50 states now. Last year, we asked us a house, did the last two big ones, which was Alaska and Hawaii. So we have to start again now. We're going to go through all 50 again.
Do a second loop. So I'm curious, Richard, obviously the trucks and the trailers pull up in front of your house like Mark's. Are you the one driving those cross country, or do you have crews?
No, we've got a fabulous guy that can move the trailers around. And, you know, that's often what we're bringing with that is the lights and the television stuff. So we use it as a signage billboard, and also our crew and grip truck. So, but it's funny when you pull into a neighborhood, everybody wants to stop and talk to you. Everybody says, hey, while you're here, come on over across the street, you know? And we had that actually on Mark's beautiful neighborhood. What What was your neighborhood, Mark? I love your whole place.
It was Bayview, neighborhood of Bayview.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right near the lake.
And it was like a congregation of all the neighborhood coming over. And I will say it is a well-oiled machine. There's seven on the crew. There's Sarah Heath. There's Jay. There's Nick. There's Mark came and Nick, Dan. It is amazing. They're the nicest people. They came into the house. They made themselves at home. They talked to my family. They gave my kids high fives. It's an unbelievable process to watch this crew in action. And Richard's right there. I mean, he's hosting, but he's getting his hands dirty. He's cutting pipes. He's working with the other plumber.
Mark, I did break a nail that day. I split a nail. I'm still having work done getting it back.
That was probably my fault, Richard, when I gave you the wrong tool, I think, or something.
I felt bad for Mark. Our radio listeners don't know how tall Mark is, but he's tall enough that it was painful having him stand in the basement next to me, because I'm a shorty compared to him. So I felt bad for Mark.
Oh yeah, it was just a blast, and Richard, I hope I thanked you enough, because you're a fabulous guy, and I learned so much, and you were just so much fun to work with.
Thanks, my friend. Yeah. It was great. Yeah. So, and I love Milwaukee. I mean, it was great being there, and everybody treats us so beautifully there. So
good.
Right, and well, Mark, had it not been for Richard and us, this whole house, would you have even considered a tankless water heater to put in your 1920s Bayview home?
Yeah, the hot water heater was getting early, and it was getting old, and I did some research, learned about them, and it would have been something I would have considered, but it's quite an undertaking to do. I mean, we had to move some Richard. You can talk to this. You had to move some gas lines, I think, and it was a complicated process. When I talked to Heath, the producer, and he mentioned that, but we were able to make it work, and they did it pretty effortlessly.
Right. And what I should do is make a call out that we had a local plumber help us so that we could get permitting and get all the parts and pieces there in the time that we had. So Larry Budiak from Budiak Plumbing was terrific, and his crew. They were there to make sure everything. We don't have the time to run out to a supply house to get one fitting when we're there for one day. So some of the logistical stuff was helped out beautifully by Larry. But, the issue of these instantaneous is it needs a bigger gas pipe and it has to go against the outside wall. So oftentimes you're relocating, and that's what we did on the segment. And I think we made the case clearly in the piece that has recently aired that it is more work, but it's worth every bit of it because you get unlimited hot water for a longer period of time. You could run it all day if you wanted to, and it will last longer than a glass line steel tank, and you save energy. So, there's hardly a downside, except that it's more involved. And what always happens in America is somebody has a water heater that finally leaks, and they want to get water back on that afternoon so that they just go right back into putting a tank-type water heater back in. They don't slow down to say, well, wait a minute, what should I really do for the next 20 years? And Mark has two soon-to-be teenage daughters that will shower longer than any human beings ever. So this will give them a solution.
It is. And my wife's a runner, and she runs outside in the morning in cold winters, and she comes in, and she just gets an endless hot. It's a very even heat, too. You never have to touch it.
Great.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't actually talked to you since it's been running great.
Love it, Richard. Not even, we don't even know it's there anymore. You turn it on, you never touch it for a nice shower. And I've even taken like 6-minute showers instead of 5-minute showers now, Richard.
Yeah.
Ooh,
a little longer.
Extra minute, so, there you go.
So, yeah. My wife wanted to say how much she loves it. Just loves it. So, yeah.
Well, and even though these tankless water heaters are common thread in Asia and in Europe, they're taking a bit to catch on here with less than 10% of U.S. houses having one. And do you think, one of those obstacles is because for now natural gas here is relatively inexpensive and that people don't think ahead? Like you said, they're often replacing that water heater right now when the problem arises.
Right. That's certainly part of it, that gas is not expensive enough. But just energy in general, people get used to whatever their cable bill is and their gas bill is, no matter what it is. And they say, I'll just make more money. And they don't think about saying, well, wait a minute, what if I could have something that was a much longer-term solution that would save me, if it saves you 30 to 40% and you've got unlimited hot water and it lasts you longer, if you can reduce your operating costs for 20 years and whatever that is, $300 to $500 or $600 a year, it's pretty crazy. People don't think about the potential investment side of energy efficiency.
Right. Now, Mark, your house was built in 1920, and it's surrounded in good company by other Bayview craftsmen or bungalows, mm-hmm. as we're known for here in the city. But as a homeowner with an old house, you probably knew going in there's going to be some problems, things you need to adjust to. But what specifically do you want to maintain in your home, and what are you willing to compromise on in modernity to have a safe, functioning home? You know, it's that balance between having a great old exterior, but needing a safe and functioning inside.
Yeah, well, you know, the hot water heater is best of both worlds. We have the house was built in 05, and it was moved in the 20s, so it's, you know, it's got a lot of history to it.
Yeah.
But it has, in the middle of the house, there's this kind of this Cream City brick chimney that runs through it. And the way the hot water heater was venting was damaging the brick. And we want to eventually maybe expose that brick and show that brick. So this is the best of both worlds, because now the hot water heater vents to the outside wall, preserving the chimney. So we kind of won both ways. You know, and we want to preserve as much of the character as we can. You know, that's how my wife and family is. We love old houses. We love the character. They're built so well. And restoring some of that original that gets beat on, but it's able to take a pretty good beating. And we can bring some of that woodwork back, you know, some of the hardware back, whatever we can.
Exactly. And Richard, you've traveled all over the country, been to various neighborhoods. Obviously, you got a taste of Milwaukee a couple times and Mark's neighborhood in Bayview. What do you think of the balance between old homes and all the new technology that's coming out?
I'm so partial to the older buildings that were built better, and they have a more pleasing eye to me. All the ones that were done in the 80s are, seems like the windows are wrong, and they're trying to get that big vaulted front entry and things like that. You know, it's just a classic brick and solid structure that represented that early part of the century, you know, the 30s and 40s, where they were built by artisans and craftsmen out of brick. It's a more comfortable feel to me. We actually did another story when we were there in Milwaukee with our fabulous mason, Mark McCullough. And we had another building in town that had all Cream City brick. And what he did was he taught the woman who owned the house how to repoint that brick, and it's an unbelievably good and complete piece. So we got really two wonderful stories about old houses out of Milwaukee, so it was a good visit.
What else did you notice about Milwaukee with the time you were here and the other segments that have been filmed? You know, does it stand out, or is it good or bad compared to other older neighborhoods around the country?
I don't know. I just felt comfortable in Milwaukee. I felt comfortable when we went to, what's that great section with all the restaurants? There's an energy there and a great feeling.
I think you were on KK, didn't you? At the Odd Duck, maybe?
Yeah.
So, I mean, our show is called This Old House, and after us, we like old.
Yes. Well, I'm sure you felt right at home along the lake you like to sail so much.
That's right. That's right.
Now, Mark, you mentioned the water heater has been working great for you ever since you put it in, but do you make a point to complete any other household projects and, you know, include your daughters on this as well? Because the whole point of This Old House and That's This Old House is showing homeowners how to do something versus pick up the phone, I think something's wrong, let's bring someone in.
Mark,
what's on your honey-do list? Come on, Mark, come clean.
Well, I was hoping, you know, it was 14 years, so I'm just actually, if they could come back a couple of days, I have a lot of projects for them, you know, especially Mark. You know, Mark could do some mason work on our chimney, and Richard could do some more plumbing on our kitchen.
That was not her question, Mark.
Well, I do. You know, I learned from my dad some stuff. You know, he wasn't a tradesman, but he was very good around the house. You know, he spent a lot of time maybe shooting baskets with me and spent his, you know, home improvement. But I learned some stuff, and you know, we're just trying to bring a lot back. Like, a lot of the doors are painted. They have three or four, you know, layers of different paint on it. Maybe strip those back to original wood. And again, just to restore, like my wife says, bring it back to how it was. You know, nothing real complicated. It's built really well. This was huge because we really wanted to keep that chimney. And, you know, to afford to do this on our own would have been a pretty big undertaking. And for them to do it in 6 hours, you know, have a blast doing it, was an absolute blessing. Yeah. And again, to watch this crew in action, to watch Richard and Heath, and it is absolutely amazing. You know, it's a true show. There's no crap in them. They come in, they're friendly, they welcome you. You know, they're kind of the family, and they are just, it's amazing. So, I hope that answers the question, Richard. Is that
yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah. I'll give you another 20 minutes to say nice things about it. No, I'm only kidding.
Well, Richard, you've been with This Old House and then As This Old House, but specifically original show since 1980, back with Bob Vila hosting.
That's right.
you grew up in your family business of plumbing, and originally your father was the one to do the segment until it was passed on to you.
That's right.
How do you view the importance of trade, given that it was your family upbringing that taught you what you bring to this show today?
Well, we're on a mission because we've been talking about it for a long time, and we're now doing something about it on this old house in an initiative called Generation Next. And what it is that we've got all these jobs available in the skilled trades, and we have no one to fill them. I mean, what happened is the vocational school system became sort of a ignored or underloved thing in the 60s and 70s, and now you've got all this housing stock with nobody coming into the industry to help take care of it. It's the number one lament of every single contracting firm, no matter what it is, where it's, you know, plumbing, heating, regular carpentry, electrical, masonry. And so there's a real push that we're trying to do is to get guidance counselors and teachers and kids to say, wait a minute, here's a career I could come out and make an absolute fabulous living. I could feel good about what I do every day, be right in my local community. I'm not going to be trapped in a cubicle doing emails the rest of my life, you know, and you feel good. You know, it's a sort of sense of artistry, artisanship. So, yeah, it's a big deal trying to get people into the trades, and we're hoping to do something to change that a little bit. We had a series of three apprentices came and worked with us for 10 weeks this year on the regular Thistle House project, and that's really had a great effect on the shows we've shown to sort of get people talking about this subject.
Right. You know, Richard makes a big point, just to hop in. When I need something done, it's hard to find someone. You know, I call my dad to help me with fix windows, or I call my mom to paint, or I call my friend who's a carpenter, hey, can you come over for a couple? It's hard. It's hard to find.
Right.
And Rich, that's a great point, you know?
Yeah.
Somebody offered up another point, is that so many of the jobs in this country that we now take, you know, that are there will potentially be automated, meaning as the Internet of Things becomes everywhere and, you know, but the one thing you can't automate is the skilled trades, the use of your hands to do, to build and to fix and to repair and to remodel. So it's a ripe with potential industry that people don't realize. And the other thing is the sad part is there are so many, the story has been repeated enough times, there's plenty of kids that have gone to college and come out saddled with college debt with no job to find and not even sure that that was the right path for them because they might have had a mechanical sense their entire life. But peer and family pressure or whatever, you said, look, I just got to go to college. And I don't know.
Yeah, and I work as a school counselor, and it's a huge thing, just trying to find good channels to get these kids into these programs.
Yeah,
you know, it's a great skill. It's a great life, you know.
I hope somebody's listening on this radio interview and just says, you know what, maybe my kid should look at it and just sniff around. And the Voc-Tech schools have come back in a big way. There's now waiting lines. So the tide is turning. It's just going to leave. There's going to be a big interval until we can fill it, though.
Right. And no matter how big or small the job is, when we accomplish something on our own, there is that sense of satisfaction that you can't get from anywhere else.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I could drive down any street and say, oh, yeah, I did that heating system. Oh, yeah, I did that. It just feels so good. You know, you left your imprint.
Now, Richard, I'm curious. Have there been any projects, either through the shows or with you personally, that you've just had to walk away from? You know, homeowners like Mark, like you said, something could take days or weeks because, something keeps coming up, and you avoided that process through having work done ahead of time, set up for when you'd get to Mark's house. But are there any stories of things that just escalated into something you did not bargain for?
Not on this house. I mean, our production crew is pretty good, and you know we know what we're doing. The only thing that I can say about that is there are many people that will write into this old house or ask this old house and say, "I want this done," and the work would take 10 weeks, and we only have one day. So that's the only sort of time when you know we walk away because when we do these remote projects like we did in Milwaukee, it has to be something that we can get done in the better part of one day. You know, we just can't be on the road spending weeks and weeks and weeks on something that would turn out to be 6 or 8 minutes of television.
Well, know. Richard and Mark, I'd like to thank you both for coming in here and sharing your insight about the segment on the Bayview home on Ask This Old House. And again, thanks so much for taking the time, especially Richard. I know you're in the hallway of jury duty right now.
I'm in the hallway of jury duty in Massachusetts. So, yeah.
Thank you. All Richard, right. I hope our paths cross again, my friend.
I do too, my friend. You're awesome. Right. Love it, man.
You too, buddy.
Be good, you guys.
All right.
Bye, Milwaukee. Talk soon.
Mark Nagel is a Bayview resident whose hot water issues are featured on the PBS show Ask This Old House. Richard Trethewey is the show's plumbing and heating expert, and he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski from Massachusetts.
You can see the episode they discuss tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 on Milwaukee PBS Channel 36.1 or online right now. There is a link from WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then coming up, our next Bubbler Talk episode. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Back now with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Susan Bentz. I was standing on the windy corner of 4th and Mitchell Streets on Milwaukee's near south side with listener Rob Bueno.
And my question is, whatever happened to the public nanatorium that housed dolphins and seals?
The short answer, Rob's talking about the South Side Natatorium that was built in 1894. The two-story Italian Renaissance-style building had showers and bathrooms along its first-floor perimeter and dressing rooms on the balcony. Today, the building is gone, replaced by a park named for a nearby funeral home owner. City leaders built 7 natatoriums in the late 19th century in an effort to, in their words, encourage healthful swimming and cleanliness facilities for those not fortunate enough to have their own baths. Rob Bueno remembers what came after people stopped splashing in the natatorium in 1977. Paintings of dolphins appeared on the building's exterior, which he saw when he would ride in his grandfather's car.
So it sparked my interest, and I really wanted to know, maybe it's a fish store or whatever it was. So I started asking questions at an early age. And then, begrudgingly, I think he agreed to take me
Rob
there.
Has no memory of what he and his grandfather ate at what had become the public natatorium. That was the restaurant's name.
But I do remember that the glass, we sat at a table right up against the glass and watched the happenings in the pool. And it was just so bizarre because here you are in what used to be a swimming pool.
So Rob wondered about the fate of the restaurant and that of its sea creatures. We head to a downtown Milwaukee ad agency for some answers.
I'm Andy Gorzalski. I'm a producer and filmmaker from Milwaukee. And I had first heard about the natatorium kind of just through loose word of mouth from people who had been there once or twice. And then ultimately through these sort of obsessive posts about it on the Old Milwaukee Facebook group.
Andy set out to learn more about the man behind the project, Milwaukee native John Garlick. Now he plans to create a documentary on the subject.
So it was the man that stood out first, or the natatorium, or a combination?
Well, I think the natatorium and putting dolphins inside of a swinging 70s supper club stands out first. But then when you go down these other layers and you find out how charismatic and amazing John Garlick was, I mean, I think that becomes the true story of this dreamer, and that, you know, the restaurant is just manifests itself out of him.
Has anybody ever mentioned the juxtaposition of the food versus the smell of an aquarium? I have that vivid memory of walking in with my grandfather and going, wow, we're going to have a burger and it smells like an aquarium.
Garlick was an entrepreneur. He sold Cadillacs, lots of them. He masterminded a gyros plant that distributed the Greek delicacy across the country. Plus, he created a popular restaurant in Milwaukee called J.J. Garlick's. Then came the natatorium. In 1978, John and his wife Margaret purchased it for $4,000 and sunk hundreds of thousands more into enclosing his pool with glass, the glass Rob Bueno remembers pressing his nose up against. The Garlicks procured and cared for 2 dolphins. Their water had to be salty like the sea and just the right temperature. But by the beginning of 1985, the wild venture went belly up. And a few years later, the once elegant building itself vanished from the landscape. What about Rob Bueno's questions about the animals?
I know every attempt for the security and care of the animals was always at the very best intention and effort throughout the life of it. I know at the very end, there was a couple weeks during the Chapter 11 where I think on a couple days the temperature dipped up and down, and they put some effort behind air vacuuming them back to Florida, and like they were on these little stretcher things. It's kind of an incredible visual, like being rescued out of a place. place, once they were transported, like lived a happy long life, I think, back at Marineland in Florida.
I got a slightly different account from Bruce Marquardt. I reached him by phone. He now lives in Arizona. But Bruce worked at Public Natatorium, first as a waiter. Then, Bruce says, he weaseled his way into working with the dolphins. Despite long hours, 12-hour days, 6 days a week, Bruce loved the work.
It was so much fun.
And the dolphins. Their names, Scotch and Soda.
Scotch and Soda and I all learned together, which was a very unique. They didn't know anything. We taught them from scratch, and they taught us about them.
Bruce says, sadly, one of the dolphins, Scotch, died.
And they bought a sea lion and tried to mix it into the act, which didn't work. You'll never see dolphins and sea lions performing it in the same pool. And then they closed bankrupt.
A few years later, after he had moved west, Bruce had an unexpected reunion. He discovered Soda, not in Florida, but at an amusement park south of Los Angeles.
We went there, and there she was. I got to go and back, and she knew who I was. Oh. After 3 years, she knew exactly who I was. And I was showing them the things that I would do with her that they didn't know she knew. It was like a reunion. I was crying.
Back in Milwaukee, filmmaker Andy Gorzalski says there's a little-known fact our Bubbler Talk person Rob Bueno should hear, the Garlic's motivation to create a mini marine world in Milwaukee. Andy says it was a thank you gift to their hometown after the success of their other Milwaukee restaurant, J.J. Garlic's.
They were so thankful and grateful for how successful J.J. Garlic's was. They never took that for granted. They've actually like said this was sort of like their gift back to Milwaukee. They wanted to do something that was kind of like out there and crazy that no one else was doing it. Let's be good back in the way that we know how.
So do you think that would have tempered your grandfather's opinion?
Absolutely.
Had he known it?
And it's the first thing I'm thinking about now. The motivation behind that, it most definitely could have changed his mind to put him in a better mindset about the project.
There's one more voice we want to add to the Public Natatorium story. After it folded, John Garlic moved to Florida and recreated himself. This time, he sold real estate. John has since died, but his son Ian says the family stayed put in Florida. Ian says his parents were always working, so when he saw his dad, it was in the world of dolphins and exotic birds. He vividly remembers birthday parties there.
Have all the kids there. They have clowns and stuff, but also the dolphin shows and all the animals, because there's always birds and stuff. My dad had a pet macaw that was always with him and was also known for like going into the bathrooms and going under stalls and terrorizing people. That was one of the memories, too. That was pretty vivid.
Ian says he carries his dad's joy in living with him, and Ian says his resilience.
I mean, for me, being an entrepreneur, I've seen the ups and downs, so I'm not afraid of the downs. You know stuff's going to go wrong. Just keep going.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Bubbler Talk wraps up another week of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Lake Effect is produced by me and Bonnie, along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayan Silver.
We get additional reporting from Rachel Morello and Susan Bentz, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for a Lake Effect weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.